From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On March 23rd, 2 years ago, President Barack Obama signed into law the biggest piece of legislation of his presidency, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. Critics derisively called it Obamacare. Eventually, and more affectionately, so did many of the bill's supporters. Well, today, in a 5-4 decision, the United States Supreme Court ruled to uphold, almost in its entirety, Obamacare. The implications for the country, the economy, for the presidential race are just enormous. This hour on Point, we wrestle with the implications of the Supreme Court's historic ruling upholding President Obama's health care reform. You can join the conversation this hour. Are you celebrating? Are you furious? Patients, doctors, hospital administrators, what will this mean for you, for us? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We've got a really top-notch panel with us today to help us understand what this ruling means in our lives, in our hospitals, in our doctors' offices. Joining me in the studio, David Cutler, professor of applied economics at Harvard University, senior health policy advisor to President Obama's campaign. David, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
From Nashville, Tennessee, we're joined by Brian Fitzpatrick. He's professor of law at Vanderbilt University, teaches constitutional law there, clerked for conservative justice Antonin Scalia on the Supreme Court. Brian Fitzpatrick, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you.
Thank you so much, Tom.
And David Strauss joins us from Chicago. He is one of the nation's leading constitutional scholars, professor at the University of Chicago Law School. David Strauss, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Tom.
So here we are. First, to the court's decision today, in legal terms, we'll get to health policy. What do you see as having been said, affirmed by the court today, David Strauss?
Well, they upheld, as you said, Tom, in the opening, they upheld the act in all but one respect. The part that was most controversial, the so-called mandate, the requirement that every individual with certain limited exceptions have health care of some form, that was the most controversial part. They upheld that. The one provision they did not uphold is, it's a little complicated and technical. The act expands Medicaid eligibility, makes a lot more people eligible for Medicaid, and says to the states, you have to make people more eligible for Medicaid. Now, we'll give you some money to help if you don't want to make them eligible. We will not give you that money. The act had also said, not only will we not give you new money, we'll take away your old Medicaid money. And the court said, well, it's okay to say to them, you don't get new money unless you make more people eligible, but you can't threaten to take away their old money. That was the only respect in which they struck down part of the act.
Chief Justice John Roberts here saying, reading a quote here, here's from the majority opinion. It's written by Chief Justice John Roberts today. The framers created a federal government of limited powers and assigned to this court, the Supreme Court, the duty of enforcing those limits. The court does so today, the Chief Justice wrote, citing in the 5-4 decision with the majority. But the court does not express any opinion, said Roberts, on the wisdom of the Affordable Care Act under the Constitution. That judgment is reserved for the people. Brian Fitzpatrick, you've been there with Justice Scalia. You've seen the dissenting opinion that's come down on the other side. What do you make of what the court has just done, Brian?
Well, I must say I'm very surprised at how the case has come out based on the oral argument and what I thought of Chief Justice Roberts. I'm very surprised that he was the defector, if you will, that joined the liberals to uphold the act. And, he agrees with the conservatives that it's beyond the Commerce Clause power to require people to buy health insurance, but then he gives the government everything right back under the taxing power. And I'm just surprised because at the end of the day, I think it means the government can require you to buy broccoli if they just assess a tax against you if you don't. And it's just very hard for me to understand why the Chief Justice did what he did here. I think we end up with a government of unlimited and unenumerated powers so long as it attaches a tax to everything it does.
We'll dig on into that. Of course, celebration among Obama reform supporters on the steps of the Supreme Court today. Fury among those who opposed it here on those courthouse steps in Washington was Republican Congressman Jeff Landry of Louisiana.
I want you all to know that today is a tragic day for this republic. This ruling basically says that our federal government is no longer limited. And while certain portions of the Constitution they used in order to invalidate the mandate. They basically have said that Congress has no limit through its taxing power. This is the largest tax increase on the poor and the middle class in the history of this country.
There, Congressman Republican Jeff Landry of Louisiana, and within minutes, really, of the hour in which all of this came down, the House GOP announced it will schedule a repeal vote for July 9th. So the politics are on. David Cutler, you were there as a senior health care advisor to President Obama's campaign in 08. You've been following this throughout this long, winding, torturous path. Here's the Supreme Court ruling. It upholds the reform in large part. Your reaction?
Well, obviously, I think this is very good news for the 30 million people who will gain coverage under the act and for the millions of workers in healthcare, doctors, nurses who are taking care of people and finding that it's virtually impossible to do so. So I think that's great news for them. I think what this will also do is put this back in the correct context, which is in the sphere of the legislature and making laws. And Congress passed this law. It had the support of enough legislators to pass it. And if people want to repeal it, then they should do so through the legislative route rather than trying to make arguments that had never really seen the light of day before this act and trying to declare it unconstitutional that way.
David Strauss, when this first emerged as a constitutional issue, the Obama administration was rather dismissive of that challenge. Over the months, many months that followed, it came to look much more like a real threat from the Supreme Court. And today, that threat not delivered as with the 5-4 upholding of the reforms. So, where were you when this first came down? Did it look like it was in danger to you on constitutional grounds? Are you surprised by the way the court has finally framed it?
It did not seem to me that it should have been in danger on constitutional grounds. I agree with David Cutler that the arguments that were made against the act were very weak. They haven't been made before. There are many, many laws that are, everyone assumes, are constitutional, that are even more questionable than this act, even though everyone assumes they're constitutional. The constitutional case should have been very easy. To me, the only surprising thing is that this was 5-4 and not 8-1 or 9-0.
8-1 or 9-0, Brian Fitzpatrick, can you imagine having gone a different way? What do you think brought us to the 5-4 divide?
Well, there's no doubt that the U.S. Supreme Court has strayed very far from what the founding generation wrote into our Constitution. And there are very expansive precedents that give Congress the power to do pretty much whatever they want to. And I do think that Professor Strauss is right, that under those precedents, this looked like an easy case. But there are a number of people at the Supreme Court that thinks we've taken a wrong turn, that the federal government has become too powerful, well beyond what the founding generation of this country thought it was writing into the Constitution, and that we ought to do something about it. And, as the Republican Party decided to make this kind of a litmus test on whether you're a good Republican or not, I think that emboldened some of the conservative judges around the country to take a stand for limited and enumerated federal government. And I think that when the politicians made this into a litmus test, it emboldened the judiciary to take up the challenge. And I think that's what really transformed this into what could have been an easy case into something that was much closer.
But isn't precedent, Brian Fitzpatrick, isn't precedent what the Supreme Court is all about? I mean, the gradual accretion of interpretation and understanding in line with the changes in our country?
Well, yes and no. First of all, the truth of the matter is every precedent can be distinguished. No two cases are identical. And, in the part of his opinion where he says that the individual mandate violates the Commerce Clause, Chief Justice Roberts says, let's take our most expansive precedent on the Commerce Clause power, Wickard v. Filburn.
Mm-hmm.
And that was about whether Congress could regulate what you did with the corn or the wheat that you grew on your own land. And Chief Justice said, this case goes farther than that. So this case is a new application of congressional power, and so we can't be limited in how we can rule here because we have to decide something new. And so you can always distinguish precedents. And the other point is, you know, the Supreme Court has the power to revisit precedents. And, you know, just because a case was decided before doesn't mean that it was right. Certainly, you know, Dred Scott was overturned. Other cases can be overturned as well if a new generation of thinkers thinks that they were decided incorrectly. So it's not, you know, written in stone for all time. But in general, we like the stability of following precedents. But every once in a while, they can be revisited.
David Cutler, the reform still on the rails here, still going forward. Do you expect it to unfold fully unless you get a repeal from Congress at this point?
There are two things that might happen. One is the Congress may choose to repeal it, and to some extent the election this November will be a referendum mm-hmm. on that. And second is, as was mentioned earlier, one thing the Supreme Court did is it said that the Medicaid expansions, what Congress can take away, is somewhat more limited mm-hmm. than what they had. So there's going to be a decision for many states about whether they want to cover more people.
To resist the federal sort of direction on Medicaid here. David Cutler, Brian Fitzpatrick, David Strauss, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point on this historic day of Supreme Court decision. We are looking at the implications, the consequences of the High Court's ruling today on American health care reform. 5-4, upholding, by and large, overwhelmingly it looks like, the Obama health care reforms, with Chief Justice, conservative Chief Justice John Roberts, voting with the majority that has today upheld the constitutionality in large part of these reforms. We're looking at the implications in this hour with some of the country's top constitutional scholars, health policy experts, and you. This has been, of course, an enormous issue going right back to the Obama campaign. Here at the 2008 Democratic National Convention in Denver, Senator Ted Kennedy, who's, of course, since passed, but this is Ted Kennedy saying the election of Barack Obama would mean an overhaul for the nation's health care system.
And this is the cause of my life, new hope, that we will break the old gridlock and guarantee that every American, north, south, east, west, young, old, will have decent, quality health care as a fundamental right and not a privilege.
Passion there with then Senator Ted Kennedy for health care reform at the Democratic Convention. As it unfolded, tremendous resistance and in conservative quarters, great unhappiness. On March 27th, during the oral arguments at the Supreme Court, demonstrators from both sides were outside having their say. Here was Pennsylvania resident Matthew Purdy telling NPR that the health care reform set a precedent for too much government power.
If this law does not get repealed, then we are looking at a government that could tell us to force us to do anything it wants us to.
And throughout, President Obama, understanding that this could go against him, it has not gone against him today in the U.S. Supreme Court, 5-4 backing him. Republicans now vowing to try to win more congressional presence and the White House to repeal. At the 2012 White House Correspondents' Dinner in April, the president joked about the secret agenda, quote-unquote, that he would pursue in a second term.
In my first term, we passed health care reform. In my second term, I guess I'll pass it again.
And indeed, he may have to. Joining us this hour, David Cutler is with us in the studio, professor of economics at Harvard. He was a senior health care advisor to then-candidate Barack Obama's 08 campaign. From Nashville, Tennessee, Brian Fitzpatrick is with us, professor at Vanderbilt University, professor of law, clerked for conservative justice Antonin Scalia at the U.S. Supreme Court. From Chicago, David Strauss is here, one of the nation's leading constitutional scholars and professor at the University of Chicago Law School. And with us right now from Washington, Joe Antos, scholar in healthcare policy at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute. Joe Antos, thanks very much for joining us. What do you make of the court's decision?
Well, of course, we're all a little bit surprised here. I think the key is the somewhat contorted leap in logic that the chief made to argue that the mandate is justified under the taxing authority rather than the Commerce Clause. The other members of the majority actually basically indicated that the Commerce Clause argument was fine with them. The Commerce Clause is, of course, more sweeping, and I think that says that the chief, at least, believes that Congress has the power to tax you, but it doesn't have the power to make you eat your broccoli.
David Strauss, what do you think brought the Chief Justice over the line here? I mean, four justices held firm in opposition. Justice Roberts came over. Why do you think it worked that way?
Well, a couple of thoughts on that, Tom. The first is I wanted to agree with something Brian said before the break, which is this became a political fight. It stopped being a legal fight. As Brian said, this became a litmus test by the Republican Party to try to see if judges would agree with them. And, of course, that's not the way constitutional law is supposed to work. But I think that does explain why something that should have been an open and shut case became so controversial. I think Brian's exactly right about that. As for what the Chief Justice did, I mean, what you can only speculate. But I will say this. We've sort of been down this road before. In the 1930s, and actually before the 1930s, the 20s and 30s, when the states and then Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal were expanding the federal role in the economy and in society, the Supreme Court tried to set up roadblocks. And the Supreme Court came out of that particular fight very badly. It came out discredited, and the country concluded that we needed an active federal presence to solve these problems. The Chief Justice does have a good sense of history, and I think my speculation would be he was looking for just the narrowest possible way he could sort of maintain some allegiance to the Republican principles that Brian Fitzpatrick referred to before, do that, but not put the court's institutional reputation in jeopardy again. And I think if I had to speculate, that's what's going on.
Brian Fitzpatrick at Vanderbilt, you clerked for Justice Scalia. How do you interpret how and where the Chief Justice, John Roberts, came down today in making the 5-4 majority?
Well, I think that Professor Strauss is correct in many of his observations. The Chief Justice is something of an establishment Republican. I thought that perhaps he'd become a bit more of an aggressive, firebrand conservative in some of his rulings on affirmative action and what have you. But I think he's resorted back to type, which is he's an establishment Republican, doesn't want to rock the boat too much. I mean, this would have been a pretty gutsy thing to do, to strike down this very important act of Congress. It would have created quite a bit of uncertainty and turmoil in the political process. And I think the Chief Justice doesn't want to have that kind of blood on his hands. Mm-hmm. He's a little more of a don't rock the boat guy.
Here's after word this morning that Obamacare, the Obama health reforms, had been upheld. Supporters outside the Supreme Court in Washington celebrated.
Obamacare for all! Obamacare for all! Obamacare for all! Obamacare for all!
The whole country listening, watching, scratching heads, and some celebrating, some furious as this decision comes down. Let's go to our listeners. New York, Hoosick, New York. Ed is calling. Ed, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. What I'm hearing all of the time here are niceties of law, and I can appreciate that, but some balance needs to be brought into the conversation. First of all, my first point is relative to the macroeconomy. If we were experiencing the same costs of health care as the other industrialized countries, we'd be saving close to $1.5 trillion a year in the macroeconomy.
And we are not. We're spending much more, your point.
We're spending almost $3 trillion. We're spending 18% of our GDP.
Third point. You know, yes. So it has to be addressed as sort of the economist view here. You've got to address this.
We need to bring that balance, and particularly when you hear these terms about budget busting. It's just talking about the federal budget, as opposed to the kind of money that would be released into the macroeconomy if we had the same kinds of experiences that other countries. Canada, for instance, only has 47% of our per capita costs. delivering universal health care.
Right, so the cost is huge. And your other point, Ed?
And the second point is the human point. Besides bankruptcy and so forth, is tens of thousands of Americans are dying every year because of lack of early intervention. And while we spend hundreds of billions of dollars on homeland defense or security.
Ed,
I think we need to bring a little balance, in this discussion.
Ed, point taken. Joe Antos, this is the point that's been made by supporters of reform throughout. We have too many people who just have gone without, millions and millions have gone without proper health care, and we're busting budgets in that way as they end up in emergency rooms and all the rest. What do you say to that argument on this day, Joe?
The reality is that the Affordable Care Act doesn't do much on cost, certainly not immediately, and not the kind of cost not the kind of actions that people really want to see. What they want to see is more efficiency in the healthcare that they get. They want the services they get to be the right services at the right time. And the fact is that this law primarily saves money by cutting payments to hospitals and not stopping the 30% cut in Medicare payments to physicians. So access to care is a big issue here. That's part of what Ed is driving at. This law really continues to keep that in jeopardy by the kinds of budget cuts that it applies to the Medicare program.
David Cutler, humanity and cost, as we look at this 5-4 decision upholding healthcare reform today.
There are really two parts of the law. One is the part that covers people, and that's what the Supreme Court had the most to say about today. The second part, which is under the radar, is a lot of changes in Medicare and, by extension, private insurance designed to make the medical care system work better. The fear that a lot of people had is that in thinking about the first, the Supreme Court would toss out everything, including the second. So, for example, you have medical care providers across the country who are now being paid not to do more care, but to do better care. And you're really seeing a transformation of the healthcare system that was on hold, if you will, because nobody knew whether waking up one morning, the entire thing would just disappear. What this does...
If the
court had ruled the other way. So what this does is it provides some degree of certainty, and it says to the healthcare industry, now is the time to think about getting your ship in order, doing those things you know you can and need to do, because the alternative is just going to be sort of Armageddon physically when Congress decides it needs to address the issue in some other way.
Opponents outside the High Court this morning chanting, "We will not comply." We'll see where that goes. Mitt Romney yesterday in Virginia, in advance of this ruling, slammed Obama health care reform, promised his own brand of health care reform.
"One thing we know, if I'm elected president, we're going to get rid of Obamacare and replace it with real reform."
Mitt Romney in advance of the Supreme Court ruling. Bruce in Providence, Rhode Island. Bruce, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I was watching the SCOTUS blog this morning and felt jubilant when I saw that the ACA had been upheld. And then as the blog went on, I came to think that maybe this is kind of a Trojan horse for the president, who I support, and that is the Chief Justice has now framed the argument in terms of taxes, and I can't help but believe that this actually adds fuel to the fire for, you know, certainly the far right, but, you know, everywhere from, you know, the Romney middle on down. In their battle against the president in the coming election, and certainly it's going to have an impact on the congressional races. Wonder what your panelists think about strategy to come.
Yeah, we'll go to it. Joe Antos, it's a mandate, it's a tax. Which is more defensible? Which works better for the president? Supreme Court says the mandate is a tax.
Well, in fact, not only did the Supreme Court say that, but belatedly so did the administration in arguing before the Supreme Court. Of course, earlier when Obama was pushing this to the country, it was a mandate because taxes don't sound good. The fact is that this isn't much of a tax. I don't think the distinction between that the Supreme Court made about taxes is going to be a political issue at all. The issue is, and you can argue that it's not well placed, but the issue will remain for Republicans that the government is getting into your business. I think that's going to be the angle, and it's not just in the mandate. It's also in the thousands of pages of regulations that are prescribing what health providers and health plans are allowed to do. There are, as David Cutler said, there are some wonderful sounding ideas in the Affordable Care Act that, if they worked out, could potentially save us some money and produce efficiency in the healthcare system. But the reality is that those ideas don't translate very well through the regulatory process.
Let's go to Herb in Lexington, Kentucky. Herb, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Two quick comments, and maybe the guest can respond to them. Number one, I think for decades there's been precedent that the government has been allowed, and rightly so, to force us to buy things. I have been forced for decades to make payments to purchase a healthcare policy for my retirement. When I'm 65, I get Medicare. So I don't see how it's any different for extending that requirement for mandatory payments into a system for everybody.
Herb, we've got it. If I may cut away for a moment, I want to go to Dahlia Lithwick. She joins us right now, senior editor and legal correspondent for Slate. She covers the Supreme Court. Dahlia joins us from the court. Dahlia, thanks for being with us. What happened here, Dahlia? How did we come to this vote?
Well, we got to the vote because I think that the Chief Justice made a determination that he was going to save the law while also being unequivocally disapproving of the mandate. And so he just made a decision to vote with the court's liberal wings to save the law, not on the theory that Commerce Clause allows Congress to impose an individual mandate, but on the theory that this is a tax.
To save the law or to save the court, Dahlia? There were lots of people ready to blast away if they had gone the other way on this.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think that, you know, a lot of people, notably Jeffrey Rosen, writing recently in the New Republic, said this was the Chief Justice's defining moment, and he did a very statesmanlike thing, for which, by the way, he is excoriated by the dissenters on the right of the court, saying it might be statesmanlike, but it makes no sense. But what he did was say, I'm going to find a way to uphold this act. I'm going to very, very strongly say that the individual mandate is improper and you cannot regulate inactivity, but then I'm going to band together, believe it or not, seven justices get together and strike down the Medicaid expansion. So everybody walks away a little unhappy, everyone walks away a little bit happy, and you're quite right. The court looks very principled, very, very in the middle, and believe it or not, minimalist and humble and all those things Roberts promised to be at his confirmation.
The baseball umpire here in the justices' robes.
I mean, I think that's what he was going for. This was a decision to find a way to thread the needle between very extreme outcomes that would have put the court front and center in this election.
Dahlia Lithwick with Slate joining us today from the Supreme Court as this huge decision has come down. She writes the Supreme Court Dispatches column there. Dahlia, thanks very much for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We are looking this hour at the implications of the U.S. Supreme Court's big ruling today on the Obama health care legislation, the Affordable Care Act. The High Court ruling 5-4 with conservative Chief Justice John Roberts voting with the majority that the health care reforms would largely stand and the individual mandate would stand, not under the Commerce Clause, but as a tax. The court finding, John Roberts writing, look, this is not in support of the reform, but if you look at this as a tax, it is constitutional under the law. Big decision today coming out of Washington. There is celebration among reform supporters. There is fury and a vow to repeal the law among its opponents in the GOP. With David Cutler, he was an advisor to President Obama on health care, candidate Obama, I should say, with us from Harvard University. Joe Antos is here from the American Enterprise Institute, scholar in health care policy there, an opponent of the reforms. Brian Fitzpatrick from Vanderbilt University, clerk to Justice Anthony Antonin Scalia, conservative in his perspective on the law. David Strauss from the University of Chicago Law School, one of the nation's leading constitutional scholars, maybe leaning a bit the other way, but everybody looking to make sense of what the Supreme Court has delivered today. Reading here, senators commenting, Harry Reid saying, now the matter is settled. This is the Senate Majority Leader, Democrat. I hope we can work together to create jobs and secure this country's economic future. On the other hand, Senate Republican Leader Mitch McConnell saying, today's decision makes one thing clear. Congress must act to repeal this misguided law. Let's go to our listeners. Pat in Boston. You're on the air, Pat.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I have a question. When this was being argued, there was some attempt to make the insurance market different from other markets. In other words, I can decide to buy peppers instead of broccoli. I can't necessarily decide when I'm going to break my leg and need insurance. Was that addressed at all in the Supreme Court, or did they just not touch that one?
Well, let's go to David Cutler. May I go to you on that? I mean, there was that argument. Where'd it go?
The argument. So what they basically said was that they didn't need to discuss the mandate as a mandate. Mm-hmm. Instead, they were going to think about it as a tax, and that's really what the penalty is for it. So the law says if you don't purchase insurance, the government will just withhold any tax refunds you might be entitled to. Once you think about it that way, they said we don't have to decide anything about the constitutionality of the federal requirement, just we have to decide if that's an appropriate tax, and yes, it is. So therefore, we don't really need to go that far.
So Brian Fitzpatrick, we heard all the conversation before about, you know, how far could this take things? Where would this go? How is the market for health care like and unlike other markets? Not relevant because it's not the Commerce Clause that they're citing, Brian.
Well, the interesting thing here is they could have stopped right there, as David Cutler notes, with the taxing power. But I think for the reasons that David Strauss and I were mentioning earlier, his desire, I think, to preserve his Republican bona fides, Chief Justice Roberts goes on to join the four conservative dissenters and say that this is unconstitutional under the Commerce Clause power. So there is a ruling on the Commerce Clause 5-4 in the other direction. And we do see the same kind of divide that the listener inquired about. The conservative justices, Roberts included, cannot see a difference between forcing people to buy broccoli and forcing people to buy health care. The liberal justices, do see a difference there. And they don't come together on that. They continue to say they are not distinguishable or they are distinguishable.
In the arguments in March, Justice Scalia asked whether food could be defined in the same way as health care, whether the government could impel Americans to buy a particular kind of food.
Could you define the market? Everybody has to buy food sooner or later. So you define the market as food. Therefore, everybody's in the market. Therefore, you can make people buy broccoli.
No, it's quite different. It's quite different.
David Strauss, what about the court's decision on what might be impelled through this kind of tax? Call it what you will.
Well, as a matter, if you view it as a tax, it's actually quite clear the government can say to you, either you buy this or you pay more in taxes. The government actually does that all the time. The tax code is full of provisions that say, you know, if you insulate your home, you can pay less in taxes. If you choose not to buy home insulation, that's fine, but you're going to pay more in taxes. So it viewed as a tax, this is like the most familiar thing in the world to say, for the government to say to you, buy this product or pay more in taxes. It's your choice. And that's really all the supposed mandate does. What I do want to sort of highlight, though, is that, you know, while the law was upheld, and that's, mm-hmm. you know, in my view, that's a good thing, the fact that things got to this point where President Obama, you know, won the election promising health care reform, he got overcame a filibuster in the Senate, got it through the House twice, signed the bill. That should have been enough. And the fact that the opponents of the act were able to wage this kind of rearguard action in the courts, even though, as I thought Brian was very principled and candid in saying, you know, the precedents were solidly against them. But they thought they could invoke Republican Party loyalty, and they nearly did. And so I think the sort of happiness that supporters of the act might feel should be tempered a little bit by just how close this was in the end.
David Strauss, you've got commentators already suggesting here that within this very big decision, the court has at the same time limited the scope of the Commerce Clause, you know, maybe to the detriment of future social legislation. But what do you think? Will this reading of the Commerce Clause with its distinction between activity and inactivity really affect future legislation?
That's a very interesting question. As I read it, the way the Chief Justice, who was, of course, on this issue, the key vote, the way he wrote it was so narrow and so closely tailored to this case that I doubt it will have an effect going forward. It's possible it will, but it did not really lay out a principle and say, well, okay, here is the principle, here is the line Congress can't cross. It said a sort of a number of things that were true of this case, but might not be true of any other important case in the future.
We got Deborah writing to us online. What a great decision. I think once the act is around for a few years, people will accept it. Not having a health care plan like this means we all pay more for the uninsured to go to emergency rooms. Joe Antos, what arguments do you expect to be, are there new arguments here to be rolled out as Republicans rally now for repeal?
Well, the arguments are all the old arguments. If we're talking about economics, the person who emailed you doesn't get it. We're now paying more for the uninsured, and in the future we'll pay more for the uninsured. There will still be 30 or 40 million people who will be uninsured, but we'll also be paying more for health insurance. So, from an economic standpoint, I think the argument is going to be that fiscally, the federal government is not in a position, and the states are not in a position, to massively expand spending in health care. And then from the standpoint of the economy and employment, the argument that this will increase employment in the health sector is exactly wrong. What we want is efficient health care, not more employment in the health sector.
We've got Charles Schumer, Senator Schumer, top Democrat, saying just as Speaker Boehner vowed not to spike the football if the law was overturned, and Boehner had asked Republicans not to be spiking the football if it had gone the other way, Schumer says Republicans should not carry on out of pique now that the law has been upheld. What about the fiscal angle here, David Cutler?
The federal budget, as most state budgets are, is in a bad long-term position. And healthcare is the major item on that. So well before the ACA, well now that the ACA is confirmed to be still standing, we have to deal with it. I think a good part of what we'll hear about this fall is the plans for that. And one of the things that it's going to do is have a big impact on, I think particularly on Governor Romney. Because, for example, part of his fiscal plans involve repealing the Affordable Care Act and then making 30% cuts to the Medicaid program beyond that. And many Republicans want to make additional cuts in Medicare. So what you're seeing now is a real choice between Democrats who say this law can work and we need to do this and it's important to do that, versus Republicans who say, no, we need to cut everything, both the existing programs and the new programs, and oh, by the way, use that to pay for very big tax cuts, particularly for high-income folks. The budgetary implications are really going to be very central.
Francis in West Palm Beach, Florida. Francis, thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi, everybody. I'm a pediatric occupational therapist. I see children in their homes through Medicaid, private pay, whoever can pay to have occupational therapy for the children. Mm-hmm. But I myself have a melanoma in one of my eyes that is apparently static, but for the rest of my life I'm supposed to see a retina specialist to monitor it. And if there's any changes, then I have to have radiation. Well, private sector won't touch me with a 10-foot pole. So every day I live in fear that, you know, what happens if this thing starts growing? I can't afford health care, so then what happens?
Yeah.
So I see this ruling as hope that every day I can see the kids. Thanks.
Francis, thank you. Thank you for calling. Joe Antos, has Francis been saved today by the Supreme Court, by Justice Roberts?
Well, it's not entirely clear.
Why not? The reforms say you've got to cover everybody.
cover everybody. But covering everybody doesn't necessarily, and we should get away from a specific individual, doesn't necessarily mean that you have real access to health care. That's the point. This is not a fundamental right to health care that has been enacted. It is a fundamental right to pay taxes so that the government can then shift those revenues into the health sector.
But Frances is thinking about her health first here. I mean, David Cutler, isn't the point that she would have to be covered? Someone has to extend coverage to her. They can't deny her.
There are millions, tens of millions, probably more than 100 million people who have some form of pre-existing condition like Frances for whom the insurance market does not work. Insurers will refuse to cover them. They'll charge them exorbitantly high premiums. They'll refuse to cover the specific thing that's wrong with them. What this law says is that the insurers cannot do that, that they have to cover people like Frances, that they cannot charge her more just because she happens to have that condition, and that further, depending on her income, she can receive some financial help from the government to be able to afford that insurance. Now, she may choose not to have it, although clearly in her case she really wants the insurance, but this law gives hope to those tens, hundreds of millions of people for whom that is an everyday concern.
Tom in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I want to just make a little personal human aspect to this conversation because it seems to have been very analytical most of the hour. I had a pre-existing condition. I was paying $1,400 a month, and then they dropped me. I was a walking dead man for about 3 or 4 months because of my coronary condition. And then I got the pre-existing plan through the Obamacare program with a premium of $297 a month. So I'm very appreciative of the program. It saved my life. Those five justices saved my life. And this nonsense, the prices are going to go up, that's wrong. I've made it a point since I've gotten this new program that when I go to a doctor, I ask about every cost. I analyze every need that I have to have. I make sure that evidence-based medicine is being provided to me so that I'm not wasting a single penny of the opportunity that's been provided to me.
Tom, I appreciate your call and your report on your experience there. One more, Jeff in North Providence, Rhode Island. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
A sociological observation here. I don't think the government realizes what it's doing. What will happen if Obamacare survives legislatively over the years, it will create such a groundswell of dissent in the American sovereignty movement, in certain factions of the libertarian right, and the militia movement. So what happens is the unintended consequences, like so much of what government does, will be that it'll create a whole new group of individuals, which exists now, even more expanded in their numbers on the, I guess you would call it in general, on the political right, a libertarian right, that's going to cause all sorts
to
of
grow.
Dissent in the country.
And you might be right, Jeff. On the other hand, I've seen surveys that say while many people are against it, they like a lot of the benefits that flow from it. Certainly, you don't have to go to a militia, though, to find response and rejection here. Here was Senator Mitch McConnell, Senate Republican leader, speaking on the floor of the Senate today.
There's only one way to truly fix Obamacare. Only one way. And that's a full repeal. A full repeal that clears the way for common sense, step-by-step reforms that protect Americans' access to the care they need from the doctor they choose at a lower cost.
Joe Antos, where do you think this issue will now stand in the fall campaign?
I don't think anything has changed whatsoever in terms of politics. The Republicans were going to campaign against the president's health plan. The Democrats were going to campaign in favor of the president's health plan. I don't think anything has been resolved. If anything, because of the twisted logic that was applied here, I think this probably strengthens the emotion, not necessarily the argument, that many Republicans will make. I mean, l- l- let's face it, what we all want is a health system that works, and we would like a health system that works in an efficient manner. The question, the analytic question, we have to go back to that, is will this law actually lead to that someday? It clearly doesn't drop us down to 2014 in a health system that really works.
We've got Mitt Romney saying just in the past, in response to the court's decision, what the court did today was say that Obamacare did not violate the Constitution. The Republican contender saying they did not say that it's good law or good policy. David Strauss, twisted logic here or something else? How do you look in the broad sweep of history at what the court's done?
I think it's not twisted logic to say that it's bad policy but still constitutional. I think people can say that. The policy question is something that the policy analysts can debate. I do think that there is there's something troubling about the way this controversy has played out. And Pat, the caller, actually, I think, put his finger on it. The mandate came to symbolize, in a lot of the rhetoric that was used, some kind of sinister government takeover of people's lives. And a lot of people in a position in the Republican Party to push back against that didn't. And they should have. The mandate is, you know, you, as a policy matter, you can like it, you can dislike it, you can say we should have, that the Affordable Care Act should have used something else. That's all fine. But, you know, this was an idea dreamt up by a Republican think tank, a conservative think tank, endorsed by three Republican senators as the alternative to President Clinton's health care reform, enacted into law by the Republican presidential nominee.
And today upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court as the law of the land. For now, 5-4, and it stands. David Strauss in Chicago, Brian Fitzpatrick in Nashville, Joe Antos in Washington, and David Cutler, thank you all for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.